The book of Esther is where we're going this morning. I do feel just a little bit bad as we've walked through the month of May. We've worked through the entire book of Ruth, we've worked through the entire book of Daniel, and this morning we're going to work through the entire book of Esther. So those are big chunks, but hopefully it'll be an encouragement to you this morning as we focus on the sovereignty of our good God. Esther, you're familiar with the story. And we'll read bits and pieces of it as we walk through it. But I think probably the best place for us to go is chapter 9, verse 1. Esther chapter 9, verse 1, which kind of carries the punch of the entire book. Esther 9, verse 1, the Bible says, "Now in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. The Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all peoples." As we begin to look at the book of Esther, I want to ask you a question. We have an illustration here. You've probably done this to a cat. You've probably seen a cat that this has been done to, but you've probably done this, where you've taken the laser pointer and you put it on the floor and you've had the cat chase the laser pointer, right? Okay, and you watch the intensity of that cat as they're looking at this thing and they're focused on it. And you can lead them up to a wall and they'll run right into the wall because they're focused right on it. Girls wouldn't do that, guys do. But what is it that you're fascinated with? Do you ever get tunnel vision in life because you're so focused on something? You're focused on it to the exclusion of other things. What is it in life that captures your attention involuntarily? Just all of a sudden, there's that dot in the middle of the floor, and your eyes are focused on that laser beam. What do you see when no one else even seems to notice? Maybe it's a particular location. You're driving through a town you've never been through, and your wife says, "Oh, did you see that coffee shop?" And you're like, what coffee shop? Nope, missed it. Or did you see that thrift shop? No, I didn't see that. No, I don't think there was one there. I really don't. Right? Oh, but I did see the gun shop back there. Did you see that? Right? Yeah, we're all tuned into different things. Maybe it's a vehicle. And I'm sure all you ladies can appreciate this, right? You all have your eyes fixed on, well, maybe it's the guys. They have that certain truck. They have that certain motorcycle. Did you see that? What? That. And you can list out the make, the model, the year, the everything. It's like, was there one of those there? No, didn't see that go by. Maybe it's a sound. There's a certain song comes on the radio. All of a sudden, boom. Everything else is going on normal, and all of a sudden you're tuned in. Boom, to the sound of silence. Or whatever it is that you just, zoom, you're zoned in. Maybe it's a name. You're going along and all of a sudden you hear one of your favorite sports players and boom, and you know all the stats, all the statistics, all the everything that goes into that name, boom, and all of a sudden you're tuned in. It's your favorite sports team. Maybe it's a certain voice. And all of a sudden you're tuned in. Okay. What is it that catches your attention? On the other hand, where do you lose sight of the big picture? Where do you get lost in the details? Where do you tend to miss the forest for the trees? Where are you prone to take the wrong turn because you've lost sight of your destination? Maybe you know what it's like to miss the rainbow because all you see is the rain, right? You're so focused on the rain, the stuff hitting the windshield, you forget to look out on the horizon and say, oh, yes, there's that too. Maybe you miss the flowers because all you see is the styrofoam cup, and you see the little paint stir sticks there in the background. That's all you see. So you miss the loveliness of the gift because you're looking at the cheapness of the ingredients.
Maybe you miss out on relationships because all you can see is messy people. Okay? I think we all can say amen to one of these at one time or another in our lives. But what if there were a lens of some sort that could help us to do both things better? What if there was a lens that we could enjoy all the fascinating details while bringing them all together into one big picture? That we could be fascinated with the details and not lose sight of the whole. In fact, see the whole better because those details are illuminated more clearly in light of the whole and the whole in light of the details. And I'm happy to tell you there is a lens of this nature, and we find it uniquely in the book of Lester. The book of Lester. Yes, adding to Scripture this morning. It's uniquely found in the book of Esther. Believers are called on by God to be transfixed on the sovereignty of God. But as we do so, the encouragement this morning is for when all you can see is the messy, the ugly, the fuzzy, the confusing details of life, to let God's good sovereignty clarify your vision. Let God's good sovereignty bring everything else into focus. And the sovereignty of God, rather than being one of those issues that has to be reserved for the men's dormitory at Bible colleges where we reserve and talk about election and providence and the sovereignty of God. This is one of those things that should be on every lip of every believer every single day. Because God is in control of every single thing at every single moment in every single life all the time. And so all those little things that we were talking about this morning are the sovereignty of God. And we dare not separate God's sovereignty from God's goodness because God's sovereignty is meant to point us to who our God is. God's sovereignty means God is at work. He's doing. And whatever God does what he does because he is who he is. Okay? You're sick of me saying it. I don't care. I want you to get it. And if we're impressed with God doing, the hope is that we'll be impressed by God being the God that he is. That's where this message is going, okay? Okay, I've given Ray the punchline. But this book of Lester, the book of Esther, calls us to be focused, fixated, transfixed, mesmerized, held in awe and wonder, spellbound by the sovereignty of God. And we're spellbound by this sovereignty as he writes his story. And he seems to write it between the lines in this story. There's no place in the whole book of Esther where it says, and God did, or God said, and God moved. But the whole point is that because it was God that was moving, these things took place. So as we look at this morning, I want us to see six truths that require us to fixate, to focus, to be mesmerized by God's good sovereignty. And the first comes in chapter 1 and 2. Chapters 1 and 2, we find that the world unwittingly normalizes life apart from the self-revealing God of the Bible. So we start out this story like you could start out just about any story. Once upon a time, chapter 1, verse 1. Now in the days of Ahasuerus, who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, the assumption is you know who this is. This is the leader of the world of the day. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa the capital, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. And the army of Persia and Media, the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him while he showed the riches of his royal glory, the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days. And then it lists them out. 180. 6 months of party hardy. This is the great display. This is the great exhibition, if you will. He brings them in and he's showcasing his royal glory. He's showcasing his riches. He's showcasing his splendor and the pomp of his greatness. When you think through what the world counts as great, what the world counts as splendid, understand, this guy is putting these things forward to get people's attention. And the world does this routinely. What is it that the world uses to grab our attention? Because if our attention isn't on the sovereignty of God, it's going to be on something else. If it's not on the goodness of God, it's going to be on some other goodness. Something that really is good or looks good, our focus will be there. What is it that the world offers as good? Well, obviously there's wealth, right? There in verse 4. He showcased the riches of his royal glory. What does this look like? Down in verse 6. There were white cotton curtains. This is in the king's garden, and he's going to invite the whole town, the whole capital, to his backyard, to his garden. There were white cotton curtains, violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple, to silver rods, marble pillars, couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. And so he puts on display his wealth. And oftentimes, wealth and the beauty that's afforded by wealth, that catches our attention. We say, man, I just can't be happy until I have that, because that is so good. And it's not that it's not good. Those things are beautiful. In fact, when God tells us the glories of heaven, he names and lists off some of the same things that are here. The gold, the beauty of silver, and the onyx, and the emerald, and the ruby, and all these beautiful stones. He captures our imagination by the colors. But when the world wants to impress, it holds forth wealth. It also holds forth wine or food. And so there's this huge feast, there's this huge banquet. Let's go down to verse 7. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. Drinking was according to this edict. There's no compulsion. The king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do each as each man desired. Drink! Drink as much or as little as you want, but I want you to understand, I am here to make you feel good. I am here to impress you with my goodness. I will do that by my wealth. I will do that with my wine. Interestingly, these are all tied together by the W. This is just the way it is. It's not necessarily the way I meant to do this. But the third thing that the world uses to impress is the beauty. And he uses women here. So we go down just a little bit further. Verse 10. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded his seven eunuchs, Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcas, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to show the peoples of the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. You've got your sex conquests, I have mine, and mine is more beautiful than yours. Bring her out so everybody can see. And so as the world seeks to impress, it does so with wealth, it does so with wine, it does so with women, and it says, these are the pleasures that this world can afford. And they can be yours if you will be loyal to me, because we find out that one of the last things that the world uses is that exercise of power. We'll give it another W, we'll call it war. Because strategically, historically, this is a strategic exhibition. As Ahasuerus showcases all of this splendor for 6 months, what he's doing at this time is he's garnering the affections of his nobles, of his lords, of his generals, and he's saying, all this belongs to me, and all this can belong to you if you will help me to conquer more of the world. And they're getting ready to go into Macedonia to conquer the Greeks. It's going to prove a fatal move eventually, a tragic move. But this is what he's doing as he's seeking to flex his muscle and get a little bit more. Wasn't it Rockefeller who was asked, how much is enough? He said, just a little bit more. My friend, if your focus isn't on the sovereignty of God and the sufficiency of God's goodness, all that you can look for in life is just a little bit more. More of what? Maybe a little more wealth, a little more wine, a little more women, a little more power, a little bit more, but you'll never be satisfied because you can't get enough. What we see is that there's a premium placed on power and pleasure. There's relationships are also reduced to rivalries and conquests. As he invites everybody, they're all put in different places. So in verse 3, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials, his servants, and he brings them together, and they're reminded of their place. And they're given certain freedoms, but they're given freedoms at the king's command. You can do this because I said so. And just a reminder, I said so, therefore you can. But if I say so, you can't. That's up to me. And we're going to see this king that he's waffling back and forth, trying to figure out what's he going to say next. Reminds us that he's the king over 127 provinces. And we think, wow, that's a lot of states. But when you hear that, remember those are conquered provinces. Those are conquests under this king's belt. He brings in Vashti, and she refuses. So he sends them to go get her, and let's see, where is it that she says no? Verse 12, but Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's demand, which was delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged. His anger burned within him. He's the king of 127 provinces. And one woman in his realm has the audacity to tell him no. He doesn't like that very well. Kings don't tend to like being told no very well. And Ahasuerus is no exception. But as she exercises her privilege to say no, she refuses, she becomes a rival to the authority of the king. And so he asks his wise men, what do we do about this? And so they say down in verse 16, Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials, all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt. End of verse 18. If this gets out, there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. There's the battle of the sexes. Who's going to be in charge? Who has the authority? Who has the right to be in charge? Who wears the pants in the family is what they're most concerned about. And it becomes a power struggle, not only at the national level, but at the level of the home. And so this becomes the way that it's a norm because we don't acknowledge God. There's no mention of God at all. We see in chapter 2 then that women become the focus as the virgins are taken for the king's pleasure. And so verse 1, after these things, when the anger of the king was abated, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, what had been decreed against her. And the king's young men who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. Let's distract you from your problems with a little pleasure. And so they gather the virgins. They bring them. They're taken into the king's palace. And they're brought to him. And we think that this is an abuse of women, and it is, but it's not just sexist. It's not just women that are abused in this way. History tells us that each year 500 young boys were brought from all the provinces into Susa where they were castrated for use in the royal palace. So this isn't just a female thing. He's taking anybody he wants and using them in any sexual way that he wants to for his own benefit, for his own pleasure. He's a very hands-on king. That's what the world does. That's what the world is. Why? Because there's a refusal to acknowledge God and his sovereignty. And we see the policy is determined by politics and pragmatism. It's a matter of who do you know? Chapter 1, verse 13, we have a list of all the wise men who knew the times. Verse 14, the men next to the king being all of these different men, these are seven princes of Persia who saw the king's face. They were first in the kingdom. They were the kings of the hill, if you were. There was the king and there were his seven men. When people said it's not so much the king and the, it was more like the king and the seven dwarves. Ahasuerus and his seven dwarves. Because they really didn't play a real role in his life. But who do you know? How close to the king can you get? Where can you exercise influence and determine policy? And so, what do you want? You want virgins? Where do you find them? Any place you want them. We'll take them for you. Okay, go out and get them. But as he moves through this story, he's surrounded by people who are suggesting things to do. And he hears something. He says, you know what? I like that. Let's do that. Oh, I like that. Let's do that. Let's do that. And you've got King Ahasuerus setting policy, not based on principle, but based on people. And so we have chapter 1, verse 21. The king does as his advisor suggests. Chapter 2, verse 4. The young men make a suggestion, and this pleases the king, so he did so. Chapter 3, Haman makes a suggestion. Verse 11, do with them as seems good to you. Chapter 6, verse 10, as you've said, do so. He's talking to Haman at that point. In chapter 8, Esther, Mordecai, you may write as you please. Write it in the name of the king. Esther, what's your wish? What's your request? The king commands it to be done. What is this guy going to do next? We don't know. It depends on who's whispering in his ear at the moment. That leaves us open to the question, who's in charge? We could say it this way. Who is sovereign? You have a king who can't even make up his mind. He's got all that his heart desires, but he doesn't know what he wants. And so he's left to figuring out what to do next by whoever's whispering in his ear at the moment. Who's sovereign? Who's in charge? The world unwittingly normalizes life apart from the self-revealing God of the Bible. So what do you base it on? What do you stabilize your life on? Wealth, appetites, power. Number two, in chapter 3, we see that the world unwittingly operates in categories that are determined by this self-revealing God. With regard to people, there's the people of God, and there's the enemy of God's people. So chapter 3, we're introduced to Mordecai. Down in it's chapter 2. Chapter 2, verse 5. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai. He was the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. Did you hear all of those references to Jew, Benjaminite, Jerusalem, Judah? There's no question left in anyone's mind who's familiar with the biblical narrative that these are the people of God. This one fits into this group, the people of God. He is God's man. There's an allusion to King Saul, a son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Both would be a reference to Saul. And Mordecai falls in this same line. We see in verse 6 that he'd been carried away with these people, these Jews, and these Jews are the people of Mordecai. They're the same people that he comes from. So Haman's going to come to him, and he's going to say, these people are a bad lot. They're different from all other peoples because their laws are different. In chapter 3, verse 8, he says, King Ahasuerus, there's a certain people scattered abroad, dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people. And they don't keep the king's laws so that it's not to the king's profit to tolerate them. They don't keep the king's laws. Well, whose laws do they keep? If the king can't be sovereign, who's sovereign in these people's lives? Well, they keep a different law. What law do they keep? We know what law that is, right? The text doesn't say it, but it's not that we don't know it. They keep the law of Moses, which was given to them by God. And this is another one of those does in the story. It doesn't have to be written there because you already know. They don't keep the king's law because they obey the king's law, their king, their sovereign. So you have the people of God, and there becomes this sovereignty struggle. And then we're introduced to Esther back again in chapter 2, verse 8. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in custody of Haggai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace. And she was put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. Taken, custody, under the charge. This sounds like captivity, doesn't it? This sounds like being brought into Babylon. This sounds like being brought back down to Egypt. This is being a slave. This is being a sex slave in particular. This is as ugly as it gets. This is the bottom of the totem pole, even though it's a nice place. But this is being brought and reduced to the lowest common denominator in all of the realm, being used as an animal. Okay. So you have the people of God who are being abused in the sovereignty system of the world. And then you have the enemies of God's people, chapter 3, verse 1. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted a man named Haman. And then there's this little tagline. He was an Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and he advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. Now, wait a minute. Mordecai was introduced as a son of Kish, a Benjaminite. That kind of gives us a little clue. He's kind of tied to King Saul. Here we're given the clue that Haman is an Agagite. Where have we heard of Agag before? Oh, wait. 1 Samuel chapter 15. Who were the people that King Saul was supposed to destroy, annihilate, decimate, wipe off the face of the earth? He was supposed to wipe out the Amalekites. Who was the king of the Amalekites? Oh, Agag, that's right. And Saul didn't take care of Agag. And this man happens to hail from Agag. Oh, there's a connection. Oh, there's a connection here. Not only was Agag an enemy to Saul, now Agag's heir is an enemy to God's people. And so we have God's people unwittingly falling into categories of sovereignty, who's in charge, who's the real king, and which side of this system are you on? Are you for or against? So with regard to people, but also with regard to times. So Haman is going to give this plan. He's ticked off because Mordecai doesn't bow down to him. The king had commanded that everybody's supposed to bow down to Haman, and Mordecai refuses. Verse 2 of chapter 3, all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down. And so they ask him, why do you transgress the king's command? Again, this is a matter of sovereignty. Vashti didn't obey the king's command, and it didn't go well for her. Who do you think that you are? You're not even a queen, that you can stand up to the king's command. He says, I don't bow down to anybody, especially that guy. This is a question of sovereignty once again. So there's an edict. Chapter 3, verse 8, Haman said, Lord King, it's not to your profit to tolerate these people. Verse 9, if it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. Well, what does this look like? Go down to verse 13. He's going to send an edict to every portion of the land. So letters are sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with this instruction. Destroy, kill, annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, on one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, and plunder all their goods. Interesting. He uses the same language that God had given to King Saul back in 1 Samuel 15. Saul, I want you to kill young and old, men and women, women and children, all of them gone. He remembers what's going on. He says, I'm not just after Mordecai. I don't just have a score to settle. I've got a score to settle. I want to wipe out these people who think there's a bigger king than those who are in charge, those who have authority. Haman is basically second in command of the entire world at this point. And one man refuses to bow down and it gets under his skin. He can't handle it. But as we're working through just normal life, life in the fast lane, life in the world center, what we find is that the world unwittingly operates in categories that are determined by the self-revealing God of the Bible. Look when this edict goes forth. Let's just see, when does this actually take place? Verse 12. Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month. Oh, okay, so that's 13th day, first month, yeah. What's the next day? What comes after 13? 14, right, the 14th day of the first month. What's that? That just happens to be the day of Passover. God is setting all of this up on a celestial timetable. And he's saying, oh, my foolish Haman, don't you understand? Just as I had an enemy before who tried to take hold of my people by a powerful hand, you're doing this right at the same time when I'm calling my people to remember that I am the God who reaches in his hand to sovereignly take control in the lives of my people. You foolish man, you have no idea what you're up against as you wrestle with the God who is. And so we move from chapter 3 and we move into chapter 4. And we see that the people unwittingly operate in categories that are determined by the self-revealing God of the Bible. Well, we've seen that the world unwittingly operates in categories of God's people and against God's people. But individuals operate within these categories as well. And not just God's people, but God's kingdom. Am I going to fear God and align with his kingdom? Or am I going to fear man and align with his kingdom? So the edict goes out, everybody's going to be destroyed. Chapter 3, verse 15, and the whole city of Susa is thrown into confusion. Wait a minute, we're going to die. That must mean there's a whole bunch of Jews there, which there were. We move just a little bit forward. Chapter 4, verse 3. In every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. Why? Because they don't like the idea of dying, of being destroyed, annihilated, killed. And you can't blame them. But this is a physical reality that they're facing, and they know their days are numbered. They've got 11 months to the day to live. And so they're looking for every trick, every channel, every path. But remember, this is according to the law of the Medes and the Persians. Once that law is decreed, it can't be what? It can't be retracted. Once it's put into place, there's no taking it back. This order has gone out, and there's nothing but nothing that can rescind this edict. So there's fear, and there's rightful fear. There's a fear of man. So Mordecai reaches out to Esther. Verse 8. Mordecai gave the go-between, a copy of the written decree that was issued in Susa for their destruction, so that he could show it to Esther and explain it to Esther, and then command Esther to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with the king on behalf of her people, the Jews, God's people, her people. Now Esther is faced with a choice. Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go back to Mordecai and tell him this. Listen, wise guy, verse 11. It doesn't say that, but it's kind of there in the Hebrew, right? No. Listen, wise guy. Everybody knows this except you, apparently. All the king's servants, the people of the king's provinces, everybody knows that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there's but one law: to be put to death. Unless the king holds out his golden scepter so that he may live. Now listen, smarty pants. As for me, I've not been called by the king for 30 days. You're putting my neck on the line. Mordecai says, Esther, don't be so thick. Don't be so dull. Don't you understand your neck is already on the line? Verse 12. When they told Mordecai what Esther had said, Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, don't think that in the king's palace you're going to escape any more than any of the other Jews. If you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Who knows? Maybe you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Mordecai says, Esther, you've got to decide. You've got to decide now. Which kingdom do you fear most? You may lose your life in this kingdom. But if you side with this kingdom, it will cost you. And it will cost you nothing less than your life, guaranteed. I'm telling you. Because there's a bigger king than the king you're married to. You may have won his heart, you may have won his affections, but you know how fickle this guy is. It depends on who's whispering in his ear at what moment, and it depends on what beautiful body is lying beside him that night. You have no idea that you are secure. And you wouldn't be the first that would be insecure in a position that you hold. You've got to choose, and you've got to choose now. Which kingdom do you belong to? And either choice will cost you your life. My friend, it's no less different for us today. What did Jesus say? He that would follow me must take up his cross and follow me. If you don't lay down your life to follow Jesus, you must lay down your life because you refuse to follow Jesus. You're going to lose your life. Which life are you going to lose? Which kingdom will you serve? Which kingdom will you be great in? This kingdom or his kingdom? We see fourthly, well, we see under this fact that people unwittingly operate in these categories until they choose to operate in them by consciousness. So, at this point in the story, she makes a decision. And she says, down in chapter 4, verse 15, okay, then Esther told them, go gather all the Jews found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf. Don't eat, don't drink for 3 days and three nights. Hold a fast. There was a feast held when she was made queen. There's a fast called now when she makes her decision and says, I'm of a different kingdom. And the implication is when you fast, you also pray. Again, that's woven into the fabric. We understand what fasting means. It doesn't have to say that, but that's implied. Pray to whom? Not to a king, but to God. She makes her choice. And then I love how verse 16 ends. And if I perish, I perish. But those words are so final, but they're also so sweet because she's made up her mind. She's planted her flag. She's charted her course. And she says, if I die in this kingdom, I live in that kingdom. And that's the kingdom I'm living for. This might cost me my life, but if it costs me my life, it only costs me this life. That's the life I choose. So you will function in one of these categories. You will either operate under the sovereignty of this world, or you will operate under the sovereignty of the King of Heaven. Fourth, moving forward in the story, end of chapter 4, we see people unwittingly accomplish the perfect will of the self-revealing God of the Bible. That as this story moves forward, this is actually chapter 5, not chapter 4, we see that the king, well, chapter 5, Esther goes in, she decides to go before the king, and as she does so, she wins favor in his sight. Chapter 5, verse 2, when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. He held out the staff, and this is really the turning point of the whole story, at least in Esther's story. Now, there's going to be a lot more to the plot line. Are the Jews going to die? Are they not? But for Esther, this was the decisive moment. And she says, I'm planting my flag with God, and God sovereignly turns the heart of the king toward this woman. And as the story begins to play out now, the people are unwittingly being used by God to accomplish his will. So the king, he's asked by Esther, will you come, and Haman, will you come to a feast that I have prepared for you? So in chapter 5, verse 5, the king says, bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Esther had asked. The sovereign who can't decide what to do next now has one of God's people whispering in his ear. And when she whispers in his ear, this is God's agenda that's being forwarded, and he says, hey, great idea. Let's do that. And let's do it quickly. They start moving forward. And Haman, chapter 5, verse 9, he goes out from that feast that day. He's glad. He's joyful of heart. He goes home, verse 11, and he recounts to his family the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, the promotions that he's received, the honor that he's gotten. Then he says, verse 13, but all of this doesn't count as anything to me. Because there's one man in this kingdom who refuses to bow down, Mordecai. And I long to see him dead, along with all the Jews. But here's something that's happening. It says in verse 11, he recounts all of his wealth, all of his power, all of his promotions, all of his sons, all of his heirs. And he says there in verse 13, he says, yet all this is worth nothing to me. Who's the only one that can take a man's heart bound up with the riches of this world and disconnect a man's heart from all the wealth this world offers? Only God can do that. Only God can do that. And he's beginning to work in Haman's heart so that he wants one thing more than anything this world offers. He wants to get rid of God's people. And God is using this to bring him to his demise. Then we see in chapters 6 through 9 that this self-revealing God of the Bible strategically confounds the will of key people. Chapter 6, verse 1. On that night, the king could not sleep. Well, let's go back up. Look at verse 14 of the previous verse. Haman's wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, Mordecai bothers you, huh? Well, why don't you make some gallows, make them 75 feet high, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged on him. Then go joyfully with the king to Esther's feast. This idea pleased Haman. So he had the gallows made. On that night, on the night that the gallows were made, the king can't sleep. Coincidence, huh? Or maybe not. He can't sleep, so what does he do? He gave orders to bring the Book of the Memories, the Chronicles. These are read before the king, and it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, who sought to lay hands on the king. And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing's been done." So the king says, "Who's in the court? We've got to do something for him." And just at that time, Haman happens to be walking in. What is Haman thinking at this time? Look at verse 4. "Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows." This morning of all mornings, this night of all nights, God is bringing chess pieces together on the board of history, on the board of world power. And he's bringing the two most powerful men in the whole world together at this single moment. And one is thinking of blessing God's people, and the other is thinking of cursing God's people. Does this hail back to a promise way back in Genesis chapter 12, verse 3? "Those who bless you, I will bless. Those who curse you, I will curse." Only one of these two plans will stand: to bless God's people or to curse God's people. And as God would have it, because God's God, because God's sovereign, man's plans don't stand. Because God's plan stands. So the king can't sleep. Haman comes in, and the king says, verse 5, Haman's there standing in the court, so the king says, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" Haman, number two in the kingdom. And he says so, number here at the end of the verse. "And Haman said to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" He's so self-centered. He thinks just the way you do. He thinks just the way I do, right? Who's the king going to honor more than me? I mean, obvious. This is an obvious choice. Well, is Haman honored? Nope. So he tells him all of this plan, and he says, "Hey, that's a brilliant idea. Why don't you go out and do that for Mordecai?" What? Verse 10. "Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, just like you've said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew who sits at the king's gate. And don't leave anything out that you've mentioned." Oh, and by the way, king, can I kill him? Timing's everything, dude. Wow, that one's off the table. Haman's not honored. Mordecai's not killed. And Haman's rise starts to descend. He was meteoric. Now he's a catastrophe. He's a falling star. Look down in verse 12. "Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning, with his head covered. Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. And then his wise men and his wife said to him, dude, if Mordecai, before whom you've begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you're not going to overcome him. You're dead meat. You will surely fall before him." And sure enough, verse 14, "While they were yet talking, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared." Do you hear that word? Hurried, 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 hurried. Boom, 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 boom. Things are happening quick now. Plans are starting to unravel. Not only is Mordecai not killed, but Haman begins to fall. His plan is exposed. Chapter 7, verse 4. Esther says, "We have an enemy." Verse 6, Esther said, "A foe and an enemy. This wicked Haman would do this to us." And Haman stood terrified before both the king and the queen, and he starts to beg for his life. The king goes out, starts coming in. Haman's on his knees, on the bed, in front of the king. The king comes in, and all he thinks is on this level of sensuality. He says, "Are you trying to attack my wife in her very bedroom in the presence of the king?" That doesn't bode very well for Haman. As they're talking to him, they put the bag over his head. And then a helpful servant says, "Oh, by the way, king," down in verse 9, Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance to the king, said, "Moreover, or by the way, the gallows that Haman had prepared for Mordecai, Mordecai, whose word saved the king, that gallows is standing at Haman's house 75 feet high. The king said, yeah, that's pretty good. Go hang him on that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Haman's dead. Now what about the Jews? Well, we just read at the beginning of our time together, on the very day when this edict was given for everything, for all hell to turn loose on the Jews, heaven steps in. And what was supposed to happen, chapter 9, verse 1, on that very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred, and the Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. What we see is that the self-revealing God of the Bible strategically confounds the will of key people so that he can strategically promote the people of his choosing. And so not only is the edict reversed, but so are the roles. And so it says in verse 3 of chapter 9, all the officials of the provinces, all the satraps, all the governors, the royal agents, helped the Jews. Why did they help the Jews? Because the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. They didn't want to work against the king's man. This is pragmatic. This isn't spiritual. They're operating by the way the world works. You don't want to cross the sovereign. And the sovereign's friend is Mordecai now. So let's side with Mordecai. Because Mordecai is on this meteoric rise in this power. Chapter 9, verse 4. Mordecai was great in the king's house. His fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. Why? Because God, right? Because God's sovereign. So we come down to chapter 10, verse 2. All the acts of his power and might and the full account of the high honor of Mordecai to which the king advanced him, they're written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia. And in fact, we don't have any written record of either Vashti or Esther, but we do have a second man named Mordecai listed in the Chronicles of the kings of the Medes and the Persians. We don't know if it's the same guy, but it seems pretty similar. 10 verse 3. For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus. He was great among the Jews, popular with the multitude of his brothers. Why? Because he sought the welfare of his people and he spoke peace to all his people. He's made second in the world. Second in the land, but second in the world. Have we ever seen this before? Who was the second man in Egypt? Joseph. Who was the second man in, let's say under Darius when he put him over all the satraps? Daniel. Now we have Mordecai, second man in the world. Okay? Now, he speaks peace to his people. Who's the his when it says his people? In the small context, it's the people of Mordecai, right? It's the Jews. In the large context, who are the Jews? Who's the Jews' people? They're God's people, right? And so, again, written over and over and over into this story is God, 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 God. So what are the take-home points? Okay, right quick. I never keep these up long enough. I'm sorry. What does all this mean? Number one, life bears God's fingerprint even when the story doesn't speak his name out loud. No place in this story do you find the name of God. Do you find anything attributed to God? But the story all over has fingerprints of God all over it, even though his name isn't spoken out loud. My friend, can you discern God's fingerprint in your life even when you've not connected the dots? That's your job to do that connecting. Number two, you will unwittingly align yourself with this world until you consciously align yourself with God and his kingdom. You don't do that accidentally. Now, you'll accomplish God's purposes accidentally, even by trying to oppose Him. But you'll never align yourself with Him accidentally. That has to be a choice where you say, you know what? If it costs me, it costs me. If it costs me my life, it costs me my life. But I'd rather live with Him than live opposed to Him here. Number three, God is always doing more in His story than writing a story about you. Okay. This isn't a story about Esther. Esther's a piece. She's an important piece. It's not even a story about Mordecai. It's not a story about Ahasuerus. It's not a story about Haman. This is a story about God. That's why it's in God's Word, right? That's why God chose to inspire this story and preserve this story and make sure it's a part of His story. This isn't a story about certain individuals, though they're included in His story. And God is always writing a story that's bigger than you, my friend. Choices that you're supposed to make and nobody can make them for you. But they're going to have impact far beyond anything that you can imagine. Number four, God has more at stake in His story than you do. Oh, that's easy for you to say. No, God says that. What's at stake in the story for the Jews? What's at stake in the story for Esther? Her life, okay? It's just her life. What's at stake in the story for God? His reputation, His character. The Lord is my shepherd. Yahweh is my keeper. I have no wants. The character of the shepherd, God's got more to lose in this story than you do, my friend. Will God come through? Yep. Not because you need it, but because He can't afford not to. It's His glory that's at stake. Number five, God will always work so that the good of His people is realized and that His own glory is revealed. And don't separate those two. His glory is His goodness, and His goodness is His glory. Okay? He will work for your good because He's that kind of a God. That's His glory. Number six, whatever happens, happens because there's a self-revealing God who's sovereign. Why did the lights turn on when I hit the switch? Because there's a God who holds the universe together and orders everything to work the way it works. It's not just physics, and it's not just because we have a good electrician. It's because God. And my friend, until you understand that everything happens according to the will of a sovereign God, you're missing out on the big story. Number seven, God does what He does because He is who He is. And here's the kicker, right? And He's good. And He's good. Everything that happens, happens because there's an active God, and this God always acts in accordance with who He is. And who He is good, is good, is good. So life becomes an adventure of looking for God to do the next good thing in life. Number eight, all of God's goodness has been secured for all of His people once and for all through the blood of Jesus Christ. All of God's goodness. That's why He can say in Romans 8 that all things work together for good for all who love God and are called according to His purpose because of Jesus. And number nine, you will live differently when you learn to see the goodness of God's sovereignty. When you believe that God has something special in store for you, not because you're special, but because He is, then you're free to live life boldly, courageously, joyfully, sacrificially, lovingly. Because you don't have to take care of yourself. You don't have to look out for number one. You can look out for others because you know God's looking out for you. It frees you. So I'm going to ask you again, what are you mesmerized by? What are you fascinated with? What holds your attention? When all you can see are the confusing details, let the good sovereignty of God grab hold of your attention. And when it does, it'll bring all of life into focus. His fingerprints are all over His story. And He tends to write this story between lines in your life and in mine. It might not be out loud. It might not be in large print. But it's there. Let's pray.